Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 28th podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today, some NBA trade deadline news, our special guest later on in the show, and of course, news about all of your Chicago sports teams. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports, and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the Tinley Park area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, head over to the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Downs Shopping Center at 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park, or give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. And I must say, what a fun way to start off this show by talking about the NBA trade deadline. So many national moves, and we'll get to those later. First, though, I want to talk about what the Chicago Bulls did at the trade deadline, because they had a couple of moves, one that was very big and two minor ones. Let's get to the big one, one that everyone's been talking about. Nikola Mirotic is no longer a Bull. He was traded with a second-round pick to the New Orleans Pelicans for Tony Allen, who the Bulls recently waived, Omer Asik, former Bull, coming back, and Jameer Nelson, who was traded yesterday for Willie Reed, and Reed ended up getting waived. So, either way, they're both gone, and a first-round draft pick. As crazy as this sounds, the Bulls finally won a trade, and one that they needed to win in order to start this rebuilding process. The Bulls getting a first-round pick for Nikola Mirotic is unbelievable, considering that Mirotic is only averaging 16-6 this season. Now, those are career highs, but when looking at the context of his career, he's usually a 10 or 11-point guy, 5 boards a game. He's making 12.5 mil. So getting a first-round pick for a role player like Mirotic, a guy who was still coming off the bench for the Bulls all season long, despite those great numbers, is a total win. It's unbelievable. The other guys the Bulls got, Omer Asik, who is coming back, he played with the Bulls back when they were good, with Thibodeau and Rose, when they went 50-16 in that strike-shortened season. Asik will provide some depth, some backup support there for Lauri Markkanen when he's not in the game. And then Jameer Nelson. I was kind of disappointed when the Bulls waived him. I know he's 40 years old, he's not that good of a player anymore, but being the NBA fan that I am, I remember Nelson when he was on the Orlando Magic with Dwight Howard, Jason Richardson, and Gilbert Arenas back in 2010 and 2011. That was the team that made it all the way to the finals. So it's unfortunate to see him leave, but again, what was he really going to do here? What was he going to contribute? A 40-year-old point guard maybe could have added some depth, but the Bulls still have Jerian Grant to do that. And then finally, the Bulls also got Tony Allen in that trade, and Allen kind of in a similar situation with Nelson. Both guys very old. Allen, former NBA champion, was very good with the Grizzlies, but coming here at 39, I believe, 40 years old, getting near that golden age, his career is just about over, so a smart move by the Bulls to waive him as well. And before we take a look at the second trade that the Bulls completed here near the trade deadline and the frenzy, I just wanted to mention that that first round pick is top 5 protected in 2018 and top 8 protected in 2019. So that's a very valuable first round pick. And considering how the Bulls are doing this year, they might already get a top 5 just because of their record. So combining those two together, the Bulls could have a very strong draft class for next season. So again, a very good move by the Bulls, and they're getting two first-round draft picks, one for their record, and one just by trading Nikola Mirotic, of all people. So kudos to Gar Peks, which you don't say that too often, but in this case, you have to. In the second trade the Bulls completed, that was one that was not necessarily big. It didn't make big news, but they still did it. They got Noah Vonleh from the Portland Trail Blazers with cash, and they traded the rights to Serbian player Milovan Rakovic. So, Vonleh, what does he bring to the table? Well, this season, in 14.4 minutes per game, he averaged only 3.6 points per game and 5.1 total rebounds. Vonleh last season played a bigger role in Portland's successes. He averaged 17.1 minutes per game, 4.4 points, 5.2 rebounds. So although the stats seem the same, last season was better known for his sharp shooting, shot 35%, a career high from the three-point arc. Vonleh here is mainly going to be getting more minutes, which is a good thing for him and a good thing for the Bulls, because they could really develop him and see how much of an asset he will be come next season. If Vonleh can prove himself here in these final couple of games before the season's over, we could see him as a regular next season. And you know what? The Bulls have done a good job at doing that. Look at Chris Dunn, for example. I thought he was a bust, and even today I still have that lingering in the back of my mind, but you can't argue with his output this year. Finally getting regular minutes, and he's making the most of them. 12 points, 4 boards, 4 assists. So let's see how Vonleh can do with increased minutes and an actual opportunity. So although the Bulls made some headlines at the trade deadline, there is no doubt throughout the NBA community that it was the Cavaliers who made the most headlines during the deadline, starting with this big trade, which I find to be debatable. So, the Cavs give up Isaiah Thomas, Channing Frye, and a first-round pick to the Lakers. The Lakers give up Jordan Clarkson and Larry Nance Jr. Now, I was in some debates yesterday as this was going on. Who won that trade? You know, it's back and forth. The Cavaliers got what they wanted. They need two role players to either start or come off the bench, act as sixth men, if you will. But I still think after that trade, you would have to be crazy not to say that the Lakers won that trade. They're getting a first-round pick from the Cavaliers. They're getting Isaiah Thomas, who is a superstar in this game today. Remember, last season, he ranked, I believe it was third in the NBA in points per game at 28.4. This season, coming off of hip surgery, he only played minimal minutes and minimal games with the Cavs and averaged 14.8. You're putting him in an environment where he is the number one guy. And you get Channing Frye, who can back up Brooke Lopez there in L.A. And all the Cavs get are Jordan Clarkson and Larry Nance Jr.? Come on. That is easily a Lakers win. They made a very smart move getting rid of those two guys, getting a superstar, and a first-round pick. I'll tell you one thing. Maybe not this year, but definitely next year. The Lakers are going to make the playoffs some way, somehow. Maybe not the number one seed, but whether it's the eighth seed, whether it's the fourth seed, they're going to be in it next year because of this trade right here. So again, who won that trade? Definitely, without a doubt, the LA Lakers for getting a superstar and a first-round pick for two quote-unquote scrubs, in my opinion. But hold the phone, because the Cavaliers weren't done. They got George Hill and Rodney Hood, and because of that, they had to ship out Derrick Rose and Jay Crowder to the Utah Jazz, and then Joe Johnson, Iman Shumpert, and a 2020 second-round pick were sent to Sacramento. So what did the Cavaliers gain out of this trade? Because I feel like this is one that they won. First of all, they get rid of Derrick Rose, a nuisance in his own right. Oh, I don't know if I'm going to play. I'm going to step away from the team. Well, you know what? That problem is officially gone. He is now on Utah, and by the way, I shouldn't even say that, because right as Utah acquired him, they immediately released him. They don't want anything to do with him. Now Rose is free to sign with another team, and I don't know who in their right mind would decide to sit there and sign Derrick Rose and have to deal with his antics. Number two, the Cavs got George Hill, who is right now leading the NBA in three-point percentage. He's shooting over 45% from behind the arc. And that's right, he has a higher percentage than Steph Curry right now. So Hill, a very valuable player, a guy who is probably going to start at point guard for the Cavs. And then you've got Rodney Hood, who the Cavs also got. Not many people know about him because he plays on the Utah Jazz, a smaller market team. He's averaging over 17 points per game. Not many assists and rebounds, but mostly a pure scorer. And that's someone that the Cavaliers could use, possibly, in a situation off the bench. So, in the end, in my opinion, at least for the Cavs, sure, they did win this trade that we just talked about, but in the end, they lost Isaiah Thomas and a first-round pick for Jordan Clarkson and Larry Nance. I cannot get over that. That hurt them now, and it hurt them in the future, in my opinion. And then finally, I wanted to go and look at an underrated trade, one that I believe could help out the New York Knicks. It was a three-team deal yesterday, one that was not talked about much because of all these trades that the Cavaliers were doing. So the Knicks got Emmanuel Mudiay from the Denver Nuggets. He's 21 years old. Doug McDermott went to the Dallas Mavericks. The Mavericks sent Devin Harris to the Nuggets. So out of all of that chaos, first of all, hey, former Bull and Doug McDermott getting dealt to Dallas, which that guy's a bust in his own right. I don't even need to sit here and talk about him. But Mudiay is the guy I'm worried about. Now, in his rookie season with Denver, 13 points, 5 assists per game. This guy was supposed to be the next big thing. By the way, he did that at 19 years old on top of it. So Mudiay was promising, considered promising at least. His second season, he saw a reduction in minutes, but still averaged 11 points and 4 assists. And this year, for some reason, I don't know why, maybe he has fallen out of favor, he is averaging only 17.9 minutes per game, averaging 8.5 points and 3 assists. So I feel like a change of scenery was needed for Moutier. He'll go right to New York and probably start, and if not, play a sixth man role right away. And I think over time, if he can prove himself, he could probably start at the shooting guard position over Courtney Lee and really do well. So that's just something to keep an eye on. I feel like Moutier could have real success if he just gets a real opportunity with the New York Knicks. From one winter sport to another now, we're going to move on from Bulls and NBA news and talk about the Chicago Bears. And this is a big story that's come out. So it involves the Bears. But first of all, do you remember on my last podcast how I wasn't so sure about Josh McDaniels? That was the podcast with Len Casper. I mentioned that I didn't like McDaniels, first of all, as a coach. I don't think he's a very good head coaching candidate to begin with. But I also was worried just about his situation with the Patriots. So get this. The Bears doubted Josh McDaniels' willingness to leave the Patriots because, of course, McDaniels had the Colts job lined up. It was common knowledge that once the season ended, he was going to firmly accept the Indianapolis Colts head coaching position. So what happened is, the other day, a couple of days ago, McDaniels called the Colts owner and told him, hey, you know, I can't leave. I can't leave the Patriots. I've been given a lucrative deal. They gave him a lot more money to stay. So he pretty much stepped away from the bargaining table and walked off and stayed with New England. That decision shocked the Colts, and now they're kind of screwed. They have to sit here and scrounge around for a head coaching candidate. I heard they were going to be interviewing Leslie Frazier. Good luck with that, because if that is your best option at this point, you're in big trouble. So anyways, though, how this all works into the Bears' play, well, the Bears, remember, at one point were really thinking about hiring McDaniels. Here's the deal, though. According to Adam L. Johns of the Chicago Sun-Times, the Bears had some doubts about McDaniels following their interview. Quote, McDaniels surprised the Bears in a way, but the team still left with apprehensions about McDaniels' willingness to leave the Patriots. So how do you like that? The Bears had an idea that he wasn't going to leave, so therefore didn't even hire him. That's actually a very smart move there by Ryan Pace. He just saved the organization from having the Indianapolis Colts' folly on their own hands. Because I'll tell you something that I know about the Bears and about their fan base and about the organization in general. If this whole situation was happening to the Bears right now, where they committed to McDaniels and McDaniels walked away and they were screwed, and now they're sitting here scrounging for head coaches, it would not be a pretty situation. And I think, to the extreme point, someone could have even gotten fired, possibly Ryan Pace, for this. So the good thing is, this didn't happen to the Bears, but it always makes you wonder, it makes you scratch your head, oh, what could have been? Because the Bears, of course, they never have good luck, whether it comes with coaches, whether it comes with players. But in this case, they found a way. And I give 100% of the credit to whoever was interviewing McDaniels. I know for a fact that Pace and probably Ted Phillips were sitting in. So you have to give them great credit for what they did and what they noticed. Because I'll tell you one thing, if the Bears decided to hire McDaniels and then he walked away like that, they'd be looked at as a laughingstock amongst the NFL community, and even amongst their fans at that point. So they really saved face by getting Matt Nagy, and now their hiring of Nagy looks so much better than having to deal with the controversy surrounding McDaniels and what the Colts are having to deal with right now. Before we finish up here on the Bears recently signed 8 players to reserve/futures contracts, which means that they will be competing for spots during training camp. Defensive back Jonathan Mincy, tight end Colin Thompson, offensive lineman Will Parisak, wide receiver Mikhail McKay, defensive back Doran Grant, wide receiver Tanner Gentry, wide receiver DeMarcus Ayers, and offensive lineman Travis Averill were all signed to reserve/future contracts. And with that, it's time to move on to some Chicago Cubs news, and boy, oh boy, did they hit the jackpot today, signing Yu Darvish to a 6-year deal worth $126 million. Wow, this really came out of left field. I wasn't expecting this. I was thinking the Cubs were going to go with a low-cost or a lower-budget option like a Lance Lynn, even a Jake Arrieta, because he wasn't asking for as much money. But it turns out the Cubs roll high once again, and they go get Yu Darvish. So let's talk about him. Let's see who the Cubs have acquired. First of all, Yu Darvish is going to be entering his age 31 season. So he's right in the middle of his prime. Last year, a combined 10-12, a 3.86 ERA. Those were stats combined between the Rangers and the Dodgers. Did better once he went over to LA. 209 Ks and 186 and two-thirds innings as well. The problem with Darvish, though, and something that I was surprised about, is he got so much money for coming off one of the worst seasons of his MLB career. This ERA nearly matched his rookie year total at 3.90. This was the worst record he has ever compiled. And on average, according to strikeouts per 9 innings, he had the least amount of strikeouts that he's ever gotten. Of course, though, not in total, but on average, per 9 innings, usually that number is higher than 10.1. So Darvish, again, one of the worst years of his career, yet somehow commanded so much money. What's the reasoning behind that? Well, take a look at his career before last season. He went 7-5 in 2016 after coming off of surgery, and he missed all of 2015 as well due to surgery, but before that, he was most arguably one of the best pitchers in the American League. He finished second in the Cy Young Award voting in 2013, finished ninth in 2012, and made an All-Star team in 2014. That was another year that was shortened due to injury. So those numbers truly speak for themselves. And even when Darvish came here, I specifically remember the Cubs were trying to get him. At the time, Darvish was such a phenom in Japan that his agents were making any team pay $20 million just to simply sit down at the negotiating table with him. So he was a big deal. And when he came here, he did produce for the first couple years of his career. Then, of course, injuries took a toll on him. But last season was technically, quote-unquote, his first full season back since the injuries that hurt him from 2014 through 2016. And he did okay. I feel like this year, now having a true full season back, being 2 years removed from those injuries, his performance and his output should only increase. The one thing that does worry me about Darvish, and I'm sure it worried a lot of other people, especially if you were watching the MLB postseason, is that in the World Series, he imploded. In two starts, he lost two games for the Dodgers and posted an ERA of over 21.6. That's just unbelievable to think about. There are a couple explanations for that, however. One could be the fact that he was just worn out. Again, this was his first year back fully from 3 years of injury. So putting all that together, getting all the way to November, you know, for the playoffs, it's going to wear you down, and I can understand that. And that does make sense because Darvish in the NLDS against Arizona did awesome and did very well against the Cubs in the NLCS. He pitched one game, went 1-0, won that start, and had an ERA of 1.42. So there were good things that Darvish did last year in the postseason, but when it came all the way down to the end of the year, way into the end of October and early November, he kind of shut down. I mean, sure, you can blame him for that, but you have to remember also that he's coming off of 3 years of injury. I think this year, being able to start the season healthy and end the year healthy, he will be able to last come postseason time for the Cubs this year. Either way, you can't trash-talk the Cubs' rotation anymore because the addition of Darvish truly serves as an asset. Think about it. You've got Darvish, Hendricks, Lester Quintana, and Tyler Chatwood. That's a pretty darn good starting rotation. So, if anything, and especially with last season, how horrible the rotation did in comparison to 2016, the Cubs needed an upgrade at pitching. They got it by getting Yu Darvish. Well, we'll move on to talk about the Chicago White Sox Day 2, starting spring training next week. Very exciting time. And for them, some positional battles to watch out for. First of all, we've got the starting rotation. James Shields is out of options. He's a veteran who is getting paid a lot of money. He is going to start 30 games for the White Sox, whether he likes it or not, and whether he does well or not. Then you've got Lucas Giolito, and he did so well last season for the White Sox. A 3-3 record, but don't let that fool you. 2.38 ERA in 45 innings pitched, and in 7 starts overall. Now you've got to remember that Giolito was a top prospect, and in his debut season with Washington, had a 6.75 ERA in 21 innings pitched. A lot of people thought, wow, this guy didn't live up to his hype, he's going to be a bust. But he really turned it on last year with the White Sox, and I expect him this year to start at least 28 games and really turn in some solid performances for this team. He is a part of the future for this team as well. Now, after Giolito, the only other for sure starter is going to be Miguel Gonzalez, and the reason I say that is because the Sox signed him to be an innings eater. He was with the Sox last year, went 7-10 with a respectable 4.31 ERA, then was traded to Texas and went 1-3 with a 6.45, an overall record of 8-13, an overall ERA of 4.62. So Gonzalez, not the best year last year, but did serviceable with the White Sox, and most importantly, 8 up innings. Threw for 133 and 2/3 innings for the White Sox in 22 starts. So Gonzalez, obviously not a part of the future in any means. He is just there to continue to eat innings for this team and be a veteran presence. Eventually, once the White Sox get that Carlos Rodon, he will most likely slip right in behind Gonzalez, and by the next season, I don't think we're going to see Gonzalez at all. And speaking of Rodon, he will fit into this rotation, but not right away. He had arthroscopic shoulder surgery in September. That's going to keep him out for 6 to 8 months, so his start of the year will be delayed. He's already started a throwing program and has already done some rehab. So once he gets back, expect him to be a very forceful part of this rotation. Most importantly, because this is a guy who averages 9 strikeouts per 9 innings. He is a flamethrower. 76 strikeouts and 69 in the third last year in limited time. Once Rodon can get a full season under his belt, I think people will start to realize just how good of a player he is. Now, until Rodon gets back, the player who is most likely going to be taking his spot in the rotation is Ronaldo Lopez. And last season did okay for the Sox, 4.72 ERA, a 3-3 record, in 8 games, 8 starts. Lopez, mostly a pitch-to-contact guy. 47 2/3 innings, 30 strikeouts, and again, he will be used as more of a stopgap guy until the Sox can get back Rodon. And then finally, the final spot of the rotation will most likely go to Carson Fulmer. Fulmer last year, 3-1, 3.86 ERA, 7 games, 5 starts. A very good improvement for him considering how his debut went in 2016. 8.49 ERA, 0-2 record in 8 games out of the bullpen. That's another guy who people did not look upon quite favorably, considering that he came from Vanderbilt, was a first-round pick, was highly touted, but last season turned it on near the end of the year, and now has earned himself a chance to be a regular starter in this rotation. And on some final news about the White Sox, Yolmer Sanchez won his arbitration case with the Sox. He's set to earn $2.35 million in 2018, and the Sox had only wanted to pay $2.1 million. So a salary arbitration panel sided with Sanchez, and Sanchez last year hit .267, 12 homers, 59 RBIs. And how crazy is this? Last season he only earned $546,000. So a sizable raise for Sanchez, and I think based on the stats that he put up, the panel sided with him. Smart move and good news for Yolmer Sanchez. And before we get to our special guest, I'd like to hit the ice for a moment and talk about some Chicago Blackhawks news. Right now, it's not looking good, fans, I'm sorry to say, very sad to hear. Barring a small miracle in these last 2 months of the year, the Hawks are probably not going to make the playoffs. Now, according to the Chicago Sun-Times, the Hawks are 7 points out of the second wildcard spot because they've lost 3 consecutive games. 3 teams are ahead of them for that spot as well. And according to HockeyReference.com, the Hawks have a 10.3% chance of making the playoffs, and get this, a 0.1% chance of winning their 4th Stanley Cup in 9 seasons. And to put that points deficit into a perspective, the Hawks have to win 22 of their last 29 games to even think about making the playoffs. That's just insane. Now, the good thing is, it's the Hawks. They do have that sort of run in them. They've captured magic before. They've won Stanley Cups. They've scored 2 goals in 16 seconds, for crying out loud, in a game they needed to win. So, believe you me, it is possible. But right now, looking at the way that they've been playing, looking at their roster, I don't think it's going to happen. And it's unfortunate. I mean, this is a team who's 12-11-3 on home ice at the UC. I can only imagine what their record is away from home, but to think that they're a 500 team on home ice, that is just sickening to even think of. They're 29th in the league at 15.5% as well on power play goals. That's also horrible. So a lot of different changes have to be made. A lot of drastic improvements have to be made if this team thinks about making the playoffs. According to Joel Quenneville, though, and here's the quote, "I still think we're capable of doing it it being making it in. So, kudos to Quenneville on having an optimistic attitude, but one thing for certain, if the Hawks don't make the improvements that they need to, if they can't master their power plays, if they can't win games on their home ice, I don't know how they're going to make the playoffs. The good thing is, there's still time, there's still an opportunity, and they have to pounce on it if they want to keep their fans happy. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He began his broadcasting career in 2006 as a student at Beloit College, calling school basketball and baseball games while playing on the football team during the fall. In 2009, he was the lead voice of the IHSA State Volleyball Championship. After stints with the Schaumburg Flyers and Montgomery Biscuits, he became a part of the ESPN family, calling various sporting events. Today, he calls college basketball, college football, and select NFL football for Fox Sports, all while being the TV voice of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Please welcome Joe Davis to the show. Joe, how are you doing, and thank you for being here on the show.
Hi, John. I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
So, first off, Joe, I'd like to take a look back at an eventful 2017 baseball season. Your Dodgers made it all the way to the World Series, defeating the Cubs in the NLCS 4-1, but they did lose in the World Series. What made last season's Dodger team so special, especially when considering that they beat the defending champs in a high-stakes series like the NLCS?
Yeah, I think there were a couple things, John. First of all, you know, the winning stretch they went on, where they went 53-8 or whatever, it was just incredible the way that they seemed to find a way with a different source and a different story every single night. You didn't know how it was going to happen. You just knew that it was. Like, there was no question they were going to find a way to win, no matter what the deficit was, no matter what pitcher they were facing. It was a really special run, and not that I've been doing this job for that long, but I've never seen anything like it doing this job or growing up as a kid as a fan of the game. Really, I've never seen anything like it. So that's the first thing. And then the other thing that stands out, and it's almost more spectacular, I don't know if that's the best word for it, but more amazing, is losing 16 of 17 right after that. You know, to go from being historically good to historically bad that quickly, it was stunning. So, I mean, for a lot of reasons, the regular season, which is, you know, what I'm involved in as the TV voice, there are a lot of reasons that I'll always remember the 2017 season.
Now, to follow up, how do you see 2018 being played out? Will we see the Dodgers and Cubs, already preseason favorites, fighting once again for the NL pennant?
Yeah, I mean, it sure looks like it with the moves that the Cubs have made. You know, the Dodgers haven't made a ton of moves, but, again, they're one win away from winning the World Series, so there's not much broke there that needs fixing. You know, a lot of it comes down to health, and the Dodgers were real fortunate for, you know, much of last season health-wise. Clayton Kershaw down for a little while, but you know, a thing that they have anytime they have an injury like that is they're always touting the organizational depth, and so they tend to survive some injuries better than other organizations do. So we'll see. I really like what the Dodgers have. I really like what the Cubs have put together. I think it should be really interesting to watch.
Now, speaking of the Dodgers and Cubs, Yu Darvish recently agreed to a 6-year contract worth over $120 million with the Cubs. Now, last season, you were able to watch Darvish for the second half of the season after he was traded. So, what kind of pitcher are the Cubs getting in Darvish?
Getting a guy with electric stuff. I mean, he's as electric stuff as you're going to see in baseball. And some nights, it's untouchable. And other nights, it's completely maddening because you know that he's got that incredible stuff. But for whatever reason, sometimes he just doesn't harness it. And he just doesn't quite have it, doesn't quite have command of the zone, doesn't quite rise to the big moments like you saw in the World Series. You know, I think that as a regular season pitcher, it's a great acquisition. But it's hard to look at it, you know, look at his postseason track record. And I know he won 2 starts in the postseason. But those were both with the Dodgers up 2-0, where there wasn't a ton of pressure on him. But it's hard to argue that he is a good postseason pitcher. So until he proves that he's somebody other than the guy we've seen, you know, when you get beyond the regular season, there's still a lot of question marks.
I wanted to shift gears now, talk about some college hoops. We know that March Madness is coming up in a matter of weeks. Last season here in the Chicagoland area, Northwestern took everyone on a wild ride that included the school's first ever tournament bid. Now, this year it seems that Loyola has taken the reins from the Wildcats. Now, with your work on Fox Sports, you've been here in the Chicago area a lot doing DePaul and Marquette games. What are your thoughts on March Madness coming up, as well as certain Chicago teams who could possibly qualify?
I've got, I'm going to see a couple teams that I like a lot this weekend. I have Xavier and Villanova on Saturday, and I think both those teams can make runs. Villanova right now is dealing with some health problems, but a lot of teams are this year. They are something special to watch when they're clicking on all cylinders. So, yeah, that's not really going out on a limb talking about one of the top five teams in the country, but really like Villanova. Like everybody else, I like Michigan State. As far as Chicagoland teams, I've only seen DePaul, I guess, out of that group, and I think there's some pieces there that they can be excited about, but they're still a ways away from being a top-shelf team in the Big East, which turned into just a tremendous conference.
Moving to the gridiron now, you doing your work with the NFL and with college football, we just witnessed a memorable Super Bowl, one that went down in history in terms of total offense, so two questions here. First, what prevented New England from winning that game? Was it the benching of Malcolm Butler, or did the Eagles simply just outplay the Patriots? And second, who do you see as a true threat to the Eagles heading into next season?
Yeah, I think you could just got to give credit to the Eagles. I mean, it's not like the Patriots played poorly, and I don't know. It's an easy and sexy storyline depending on the Malcolm Butler thing. I don't think that you can do that fairly, but... Yeah, I think just sometimes one team plays better than the other, and the Eagles on that day were a little bit better than the Patriots. And I mean, next season it's hard to look at the Eagles and try to match them up with everybody else, just because they're going to look different because they're going to have a different guy at quarterback than they had making the Super Bowl run. You know, you're probably going to see Carson Wentz as the starting quarterback. So in trying to figure out who's going to challenge the Eagles, it's hard because. It's hard to even know exactly what the Eagles are going to look like. But, I think they're going to be around for a while with the pieces that they have.
So I wanted to move on now and shift gears, talk about your broadcasting career. It's amazing. First off, how did you become the recognizable voice that we all know today? And in regards to your Dodgers broadcasting career, I'm under the understanding that it involved the Taco Bell near the Cubby Bear by Wrigley Field. I would love to hear this story.
Yeah, so when I was in college, I wrote a letter to Len Casper, the Cubs TV guy, just asking for advice and explaining that I was a fan of his and wanted to get into the industry, and set it to a Cubs game with my dad, and we parked across Wrigleyville, walked to the ballpark, and planned on taking the letter to the press box entrance and getting it to a security guard there so he could get it up to Len. Well, I got to the press box, and the letter was gone. It had fallen out of my pocket on the walk. So I was obviously bummed out, but after the game on our drive home back to Michigan, I got a call from the owner of the Taco Bell across the street from Wrigley. Somebody had found the letter on the sidewalk and brought it into her, and she assured me that she'd make sure Len got it. And sure enough, a couple weeks later, I got an email from Len, and he turned into a really great mentor for me, still is a great mentor for me.
That's such an amazing story. I just have to say, from the Taco Bell to getting where you are today, it's amazing. So being with the Dodgers, you were tasked with replacing Vin Scully, most arguably one of the greatest broadcasters of all time. So was this intimidating for you, knowing that you had to fill the shoes of such a legendary voice?
You know, I don't know if intimidating is the word, because I think if you get too caught up in the pressure of the whole thing, because people, you know, there is pressure in it if you really want to look at it that way, but I don't think that gives you too much of an opportunity, too good of a chance to succeed in it. If you're too caught up in the pressure or the intimidation factor of being the guy to follow him, I kind of looked at it as a responsibility more than anything. And the Dodger fans have had the best announcer of all time doing their games ever since the team moved to Los Angeles in 1958. And so to be the guy to follow him, you know, an incredible responsibility, but one that I don't think that I would handle very well if I tried to do anything other than just be me. So that's what I tried to do, and you know, hopefully over time Dodger fans will learn to enjoy that.
Now, being you, in my opinion at least, has worked out very well in L.A., Something that I wanted to talk about is your viral sensation that had to do with the hashtag this team. So, how did this all come about, and is it true that you make a small royalty every time the hashtag is used?
You know, it's funny. I you may be the only person that I've heard make that connection, that I was the one who said that on a broadcast, and then it kind of became a hashtag. I'm not sure that many other people make that connection. So maybe we need to get my agents on that, right? Like, make sure I start getting a cut off of it. But no, any time something like that happens, and this team gave us, I honestly didn't mean to do that, to say this team like that, but the Dodgers this summer gave us so many memorable moments that, you know, I just happened to be sitting in the chair to hopefully put a nice caption on. And anytime that happens, and anytime there's a call that people kind of latch on to, it's so gratifying. You know, it's kind of one of the things you get into this business for, to be a small part of those very big moments. And the tough part about the big moments is the only way to get better at them is to have them happen. And the only way to have them happen and have practice is to be sitting in the chair when they do. You know, you kind of got to get lucky. And they gave me a lot of practice this year at getting the call big moments, that's for sure.
Absolute madness, another one, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that was a wild one.
So, on a final note, I noticed through your Instagram and Twitter profile that you are a grilling and smoker enthusiast. I mean, you even retweeted an article from BarbecueAddicts.com, and based on your Instagram today, even, you were up at 4:42 this morning doing grilling and smoking. So, how did this passion outside of baseball come about?
Yeah, actually, I got a pork shoulder and some beef ribs on the Big Green Egg right now. My dad always grilled just on a Weber kettle. So I think that on a basic level, I got the interest from him, but I've definitely taken it to a level beyond that. And, you know, I really don't have a ton of true hobbies. I've got my job. I've got my family. I'm not a golfer at this point. I don't like have a boat or anything like that. I'm a pretty boring guy, but this has just kind of become my hobby. You know, I went from grilling a lot on just Weber kettles to teaching myself through YouTube videos and just reading stuff online how to smoke meat, and just a fun way to kind of kick back and enjoy a day when I'm at home, you know, in the off season, trying to take advantage of that time as much as I can. And it's a good excuse to kind of be lazy for a day and have a nice pot of gold at the end of the rainbow at the end of the day when the food's ready.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for being here on the show. Awesome interview. It was really a pleasure.
Okay, John, thanks for having me.
So, once again, a special thank you to Joe Davis for being here on the show. I was telling him off the air, you know, I've been a big fan of him. I've been following him since he was here with the IHSA. I also told him, you know, that when they simulcast the Dodgers games late at night on MLB Network, I always make sure to tune in. So, just an awesome moment to have him on, and a great person, too. We're going to move on now to our closing segment, the announcer's call of the day, my favorite one. And because Joe Davis was on the show, we're going to load up a clip for you. Let me tell you the situation. So the Dodgers entered the ninth inning against the Philadelphia Phillies back in April, trailing by 2 runs. They hit back-to-back home runs to tie the game. Then they had runners at first and second with 2 outs, Adrian Gonzalez at the plate. What would happen next would be something spectacular. Let's listen to Joe Davis make this call.
Bounce to the hole. Picked off the glove and in the left. The Dodgers win it. A night to remember.
Awesome call there by Joe Davis. And again, thank you to him for being on the show today. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Thank you for tuning in. We really appreciate it. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Chi Talk Sports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zacks. One more time, thank you to Joe Davis for being here on the show. Thank you again for listening, and have a great day.